few weeks back, actually quite a few weeks back, we heard from the American writer Ted Conover about the importance of roads in shaping our communities and our destiny. He made the point that we tend to take them for granted, that we give little thought to why they start where they do and end in a certain place, and what that means for our lives. Now, it also occurs to me that we pay very little attention to what they're made of. Bitumen, concrete, or compacted dirt, who cares? But here's an interesting thought. What if the road outside your house wasn't just a thing to drive on? What if it was also a generator of power? And what if it was made of a product that you wouldn't normally associate with road construction? What if it was made of glass?
If you get on the internet, just Google strength of materials or hardness scale, you'll see that glass falls between steel and stainless steel as far as strength is concerned. And when these guys talk formulas, they can add things to that, chemicals to that formula that will make it even stronger, make it scratch resistant. And there's all kinds of stuff they can put on the surface to give it traction. And we also intend to put a pattern on that surface for traction, because one of my specs was it has to have at least the traction of asphalt, even when wet.
So why build highways of glass? Well, it's all to do with energy efficiency, and that's the topic for today's program. Hello, Anthony Fennell here, and welcome. Also coming up, we'll hear about the Jevons paradox, we'll speak with Lachlan Andrew from the Centre for Advanced Internet Architectures, and we'll also talk about product obsolescence with Dr. Miles Park from the Faculty of the Built Environment at the University of New South Wales.
When you buy these new eco-efficient products, it can change your behaviour. This is referred to as a rebound effect, where by the psychological thinking that, well, this product is saving me energy. Indeed, it may be saving me money. So therefore, you may be inclined to change your behaviour, leave the lights on longer, or perhaps you've bought a new eco-efficient car. Perhaps you'll drive further and more frequently.
I met my wife when we were 3 and 4 years old in Southern California. And back then, her mother used to babysit me, so we pretty much grew up together as small children anyways. And my family moved to Ohio when I was 8 years old, and we became pen pals and stayed in touch and eventually got married and wound up here in Idaho.
Meet Scott Brusaw, the road builder with a difference.
When I was a little kid, my favorite toy was my slot car track, little electric cars. And my brain idea as a child was if we could make real roads electric, then kids could drive. Coincidentally, when I grew up and went to college, I earned my master's degree in electrical engineering, and Julie got hers in counseling, and we're married now. And then a few years ago, when all this talk about global warming started hitting the news, we were out in the garden one day, and Julie turned to me and said, "Can't you make your electric roads out of solar panels?" And I kind of laughed at first. I said, "No, you can't even step on a solar panel. They're very fragile. You'd crush it." But we batted the idea around, and we started thinking about that little black box on an airplane. That thing houses sensitive electronics and can withstand the worst of airplane crashes. So I thought, if we could make a structurally engineered case, then we can put whatever we want in there as long as it's protected. And the first thing would go in there would be solar cells, of course. But then Julie and I were now in our 50s, and we live on a long, winding, mountainous road, and it's kind of hard to see the lines at night. So I thought, what if we threw some LEDs in there and lit the road from underneath, paint the lines, the shoulder lines and the center strip, with white and yellow LEDs. So it just started rolling from there. What if we put sensors in the road? Because we live out in the middle of nowhere. We have, moose and deer walk out in front of us all the time. Well, if you had a load cell, which makes it a weight machine, then if an animal walked out onto that road, the road would detect it.
So the Brusaw idea isn't just to make glass roads with embedded solar panels, as if that isn't an out-there idea in itself. It's to create intelligent highways that pay for themselves. In the States and online, his proposal has received quite a bit of attention. And just last month, his company won a $50,000 prize.
Eventually, it wouldn't work until we get the whole country covered, for instance, or the whole region covered. Eventually, like I said, we live on a long country road. Nobody's out here. There might be a 10.5-mile stretch. There might be 100 homes on this road. So it's going to make a whole lot more electricity than we can use. All of that electricity will go to the nearest town, which happens to be Sandpoint, 30 miles away. And if you look, you think of a city like New York or Chicago or maybe Sydney, I'm not sure what I call a vertical city, there wouldn't be enough surface area to power the entire city. But if you get on Google Earth and zoom down over New York, for instance, look at all the highway arterials that are coming into that city that spread out across the country. all of those roads would be feeding that city.
And of course, there are car parks as well, aren't there?
Yes. And then that's how we'll go at first. We'll go into parking lots first. We got a contract from the U.S. Federal Highway Administration last fall to build the first solar road panel prototype. We finished that earlier this year. And they want us to go into parking lots first because a parking lot is basically slow-moving, lightweight vehicles. That's where they want us to learn our lessons. We know there's going to be breakage and things are going to go wrong, and we have to perfect the technology in a parking lot rather than on an open road.
Now, one of the things about this project is going to be cost, of course. And
yes.
While if it went to plan, there would be enormous savings in terms of energy generation because roads, as you say, would become power plants and help generate money. But the initial cost of constructing these roads is going to be a lot more than constructing bitumen or tarmac roads, isn't it?
It'll be probably three times more expensive initially and up front. But what happens is your asphalt and concrete, which is what we've been using for over 100 years, at least here, you don't get anything back from it. There's no return on investment whatsoever. Everything's lost, except what you recycle at the end. This is a system that will pay for itself over its lifespan. And at the end of its lifespan, we're trying to design it to last 20 years. At the end of that 20 years, you don't throw it away. Virtually everything in there is recyclable. You know, the glass surface, the internal support structure, the base plate. And whatever is not damaged doesn't need to be replaced. You basically just pull it up and retrofit it. You have to replace your solar cells and your LEDs and some of the electronics, and that's it. If other parts aren't damaged, just put it back together and put it back down. And that's the nice thing about the system is, like, right now, if we were going into production tomorrow, you know, very common efficiency solar cells right now is right around 15%. Think about what happens if we put those in today, and 20 years from now we pull it up and we retrofit it with whatever the common efficiency is 20 years from now. It might be 40, 60%, we don't know. But what that means, as soon as we retrofit or refurbish that panel, it's suddenly producing a lot more power than it used to. And that will help us to keep up with the increased energy demand when everybody starts switching over to all electric vehicles, you know, electric motors in their house, electric heaters.
Now, for a lot of people, the whole idea of a road made out of glass is going to freak them out to an extent. I mean, not something
that
I imagine a lot of people would think would be a good thing to, you know, a good surface to drive on. What about those issues?
A lot of people picture, they think of their window, and, you know, everybody knows glass is slick when it's wet, so they picture a window pane laying on the ground. The first time it rains, everybody slide off the road. But what we're doing, and of course that's true if that's all you did, but what you have to remember is glass comes in a lot of different forms, and what you've got sitting there in your window is probably the easiest and least technical type of glass. If you talk to glass experts, they talk in formulas. For instance, I got invited to a 2.5-day international glass workshop in Virginia a couple years ago and got quite an education. I'm not a glass expert myself. I'm an electrical engineer. But they showed us glass that you could bend like a piece of paper all the way over, and it was actual glass, not plastic. And if you think of anything from that to bulletproof glass, for instance, I even talked to a university about blast-proof glass that they're putting in troop carriers in Iraq, where you could detonate a bomb 4 feet away, and it would, they didn't say it was bomb-proof, but it was bomb-resistant. It wouldn't let that glass be blown into the vehicles to hurt the troops. So it can be that strong. And if you get on the internet, just Google strength of materials or hardness scale, you'll see that glass falls between steel and stainless steel as far as strength is concerned. And when these guys talk formulas, they can add things to that, chemicals to that formula that will make it even stronger, make it scratch resistant. And there's all kinds of stuff they can put on the surface to give it traction. And we also intend to put a pattern on that surface for traction, because one of my specs was it has to have at least the traction of asphalt even when wet.
But you still estimate that it will only be, three times the cost of a traditional road?
Yeah. Asphalt has really skyrocketed in the past 5 years. I was told that it's gone up like 500%. And that's why the Federal Highway Administration is looking for any kind of paving material that can pay for itself.
Well, Scott Brusaw, many thanks and good luck.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
And this is Future Tense on ABC Radio National, Radio Australia and on the net. Now, let's meet another person with a focus on energy efficiency. He's Jeb Brugman. He lives in Canada. He's a design and innovation expert, and he was in Australia recently to talk about urbanisation and sustainability, in particular the concept of urban mining. Jeb Brugman.
The question is this. With the amount of urbanised area in the world that now is home to approaching 4 billion people, have we not already accumulated enough material over the 100 or so years that this cityscape has existed, that if we begin to mine it, we can find the materials we need for our industrial and building processes into the future. So the front end of this was, of course, recycling concrete. Now you see companies in the UK, for instance, a company in Wales, that actually creates a household building material, like a concrete block, out of the mix of waste that is in the everyday waste stream. Compacts it in different kinds of ways. You see recycled lumber for decking and things like that, which is a very high quality. Friends of mine in Toronto are using it. So that's the one part. The other part now is mining metals from landfills. So in New Jersey, the state I grew up in, and in Florida, there are companies that are in partnerships with municipalities to mine the iron out of the landfills, and they find that it's half the cost for them to recycle the iron they can extract from the landfill than to get virgin iron. You've got a real mining operation happening. The other frontier, which of course is, how do we get these really scarce, high-quality, so-called strategic metals? A big industry is developing around cell phones and all the very important metals that are in cell phones, which, you know, go into the municipal waste stream. How do we make them part of a recycling system of using those metals over and over again? Now, no city is going to have all of the materials it needs within its region. So the key thing about urban mining is that cities need to still trade with one another in these materials. But my argument is that today's big mining companies need to develop the find their next round of resources within the cities themselves.
What are the difficulties, though? You know, is there a downside? If there is, what is it?
There are many challenges, I would put it that way. This is all uncharted territory. First, even with the building materials, from an engineering point of view, you know, from a materials engineering point of view, are they of the quality, of the stability? Do they work in earthquake areas the same way as the materials we're used to using? So, you know, the builders have to learn how to work with these materials. So you've got a whole generation of materials being introduced in that people have to get accustomed to and test and find the weaknesses for and then improve on those weaknesses. And there's a product improvement process that's happening there. The bigger challenge probably is that there's not a regular industrial supply chain happening. So there's all these little systems that are happening. But, you know, I think that's how the auto industry or the steel industry or the oil industry started. And when I grew up in the eastern United States, and this oil industry in the U.S. started in Pennsylvania, and it served the greater New York area. So in that way, I think we have many experiments taking place. There will be lots of innovation and standards issues that need to be dealt with. And I think our best hope is that today's large mining companies will see this as a future opportunity and start investing in it as a growth strategy.
And what about a change of mindset, not just from the construction industry, if you like, the builders of products or the manufacturers, but from consumers? Because for all the talk and all the advances we've made in terms of recycling in our everyday lives, we've also become enormous consumers. We've also become enormous wasters of product at the same time, haven't we?
Well, particularly, for instance, wood products. I think in Australia you use a lot of wood in construction as well. This stuff tends to get thrown away and burnt. It breaks when you take it apart and that kind of thing, and you don't want it to break. But my experience in North America is that these recycled building products for the household level that you'd pick up at your hardware store to build a deck or something like that, they're very well received. The prices are a bit higher, so people who buy them who are willing to pay a premium, but they last much longer. So the people I know who have used this recycled, it's kind of, I guess, plastic decking, have raved about the quality of it. They don't have to stain it every year. They don't have to paint it every year. It'll last for 100 years, and they're quite happy with it. But again, this is all a matter of good product development. And what we see happening is lots of little companies experimenting with waste streams and figuring out what they can put on the market with them. And some of them will succeed and some of them will fail, like the emergence of any industry. But I think in terms of government and environmentally conscious consumers, we need to give them a chance. We need to give them the same chance that we gave the local concrete industry or the steel industry when they started in our countries, and see that this is the way that we'll actually be able to have a more stable supply of building products and metals in the future as the prices go up, and particularly where those scarce metals begin to compete territorially for access to those metals, as we're seeing now in Africa, for instance.
Jeb Brugman, and we'll hear more from him in a few weeks' time. And I should have said this earlier, but thanks to Don O'Brien, who got in touch with us via Twitter and alerted us to Scott Broussard's Solar Roadways project. So thanks very much, Don. Now, Energy efficiency. As we've heard, it's a plus. But is it always a plus? At the beginning of the program, I mentioned the Jevons paradox. So let's get a definition from Wikipedia.
In economics, the Jevons paradox, sometimes called the Jevons effect, is the proposition that technological progress that increases the efficiency with which a resource is used tends to increase rather than decrease the rate of consumption of that resource.
So in layman's terms, getting rid of the old inefficient light bulbs in your house isn't going to reduce your power consumption one little bit if all you do is replace those globes with four times as many energy-efficient downlights and then leave them on. All the time. Get the idea? Dr. Miles Park is the head of industrial design in the Faculty of Built Environment at UNSW, and he recently delivered a public lecture entitled E-Waste: Designing Out Obsolescence. He argues that given the nature of our techno-charge throwaway society, energy-efficient appliances may in fact be increasing our environmental impact.
Well, e-waste is one of the fastest growing sectors of municipal waste. It's growing three times faster than any other type of municipal waste, and that is reflected in approximately 17 million televisions and computer-related products being discarded each year. While we're buying 2.4 million of these things a year, we're ditching 1.61 million units a year. Most of that's ending up in landfill, but curiously, a lot of it also is going into storage. This is compounded by 14 to 16 million unused mobile phones, which are languishing in people's desks and drawers across the country. Worldwide, the volume of e-waste is expected to grow to 3 to 5% a year.
Talk to us about this idea of eco-obsolescence.
Well, eco-obsolescence is based on the assumption that it is better to replace old, inefficient products with more or newer eco-efficient products. So we have an enforced obsolescence happening, not because products are breaking down or that we just want new ones, but an actual encouragement to upgrade and buy new stuff, which is supposed to be more energy efficient.
And people are doing that because they're upgrading, because they think they're doing the right thing. They're getting rid of those old appliances, which they know chew up a lot of electricity, going for ones which they're told will chew up less electricity. Is that correct?
Yes, indeed. In fact, in many cases, that probably is what's happening. But it is based on the assumptions that we are getting energy savings or indeed environmental loads from the consumption of these new products is reducing. But this is unproven. And if you think of all the embodied energy and resources that go into making these products in the first place, we have to quantify that in the overall lifespan impacts associated with that product. So we can't just rely upon the fact that people will use products, the new eco-efficient products, in the same way and minimise energy.
And in fact, you've pointed out, haven't you, in a recent speech, that people don't use them in the same way, that because they suddenly have an eco-product, they think that they can use it much more than they did in the past, say, leaving the lights on for longer because they're supposed to be low energy, or actually having, say, more lights in a room than they used to have.
Well, indeed. And just on top of that is that the totality of all the products we have in our home has more than doubled in the last 20 years. So we've actually got more energy-consuming products anyway within our household. So just in the cumulative impact of all those products burning some power is increasing. In fact, it's doubled household energy consumption in the last 30 years. But yes, when you buy these new eco-efficient products, it can change your behaviour. This is referred to as a rebound effect, where by the psychological thinking that, well, this product is saving me energy. Indeed, it may be saving me money. So therefore, you may be inclined to change your behaviour. Leave the lights on longer, or perhaps you've bought a new eco-efficient car. Perhaps you'll drive further and more frequently.
If that change in behaviour has occurred over a period of time, what hope is there that we're going to be able to recognise that and to modify the way we operate?
Well, I think the first thing is we need to quantify and understand how significant these rebound effects are. They've been written about mainly by energy economists and trying to quantify what that means in terms of energy demands and so forth. But if we are to develop a whole raft of policy and measures around encouraging people to take up new eco-efficient products, well, then we have to be quite sure that there's going to be the payoff that was intended by promoting those sorts of schemes in the first place.
And is part of the problem that built into the way we manufacture, built into all of the strategies for manufacturing and for selling those products, is this idea that obsolescence is actually a good thing, that we should be striving for that?
Well, my own profession, industrial design, has shared that history with obsolescence from the time of the Great Depression, when industrial design was first conceived, to lift sales in a stagnant market in the United States. So there has long been a perception and a desire to encourage people to consume newer products, perhaps a little sooner than necessary. But the function of obsolescence is driven by a whole lot of other factors too. Technological obsolescence is a huge driver for the churn in products that we're discarding and consuming at the moment.
Dr. Miles Park, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you.
We've been spoilt for many years by something they call Moore's Law, which says that computers get faster at a very predictable and very rapid pace. And so everyone's becoming used to computers getting faster, memory getting bigger. So everything's designed on the assumption that we can consume more and more resources. But because resources are limited, and particularly because heat is becoming a major issue inside microprocessors, Moore's Law is slowing down. And so people are having to expect slower growth in the development of computers and such like. And instead of expecting everything to get faster all the time, and instead of expecting new features to be added all the time, we should be looking for improvements in more subtle ways and improvements in the user experience that we get without necessarily the growth accompanying that.
Lachlan Andrew from the Centre for Advanced Internet Architectures at Swinburne University is our final guest for today. And he's been researching ways in which the efficiency of the internet can be improved without getting people's backs up. I'll let him explain.
Computers can run much faster at a peak speed than they often need to in quiet times. And so one of the things we're looking at is optimally controlling the speed that computers run so that they're only running as fast as they need to at a given time. This can save a lot of energy in the quiet times, but at the same time give reasonable performance that people demand in the peak times when it's really needed. And we're looking at strategies to control computers to do that, and also strategies to control groups of computers, turning on some computers or turning off some computers, so that we're delivering the resources when they're needed.
So we're talking about finding ways to slow down the way in which computers operate in a way that the consumer won't really notice, or it won't affect what they want to do with the internet. But is it also important to make them realise that there is a need to do this, that this is still going on, that these computers are being purposely slowed?
Yeah, it's a very fine line to tread. It's important that the user experience not be significantly harmed by the techniques that we're introducing. It's important that the user experience be as if computers were running at full speed all the time. But at the same time, if people aren't aware of the resources that are being consumed, then we run the risk of encountering Jevons' paradox, which says that if we make something more efficient, then it becomes cheaper to provide it. And so the total amount of energy that is used in the system might actually increase as a result of energy-saving measures. So this happened in the Industrial Revolution when they made steam engines very much more efficient. They actually found that the amount of coal that was used was increased dramatically instead of being decreased as they'd expected, because so many things which couldn't be done earlier were now made possible using the steam engine. And many people are concerned that the same is happening with IT. If we make computers more efficient, then it's going to dramatically increase the amount of computing that is done, which will potentially increase the total amount of energy consumed. However, that must be balanced against the fact that there are many activities which currently consume a lot of energy, such as physical transport, which can be replaced by virtual equivalents, such as downloading a movie instead of driving to a video store. So there's a very complex social interaction between increasing IT energy consumption and decreasing total energy consumption of society, and many unresolved questions.
Now, somebody listening to this might say, why are computers being made in the way they are? Why are they being made in a way that is perhaps wasteful of energy?
That's a very good question. The energy consumption per operation of computers has been decreasing ever since the first computers were made. So we're certainly producing computers almost as efficiently as we can for the things we're expecting of them. But as long as there's economic demand for faster and better computers with more flashy graphics and more smooth animation and such like, people will continue trying to build very, very fast and very powerful computers, which very often then sit on but idle for many hours a day.
So in one sense, while it's important to address the technological side of our energy usage when it comes to the internet and computers, there's also an educational, there's a human component that we can only address through better education, better information, isn't there?
That's true.
Is it possible to estimate the amount of energy usage from information and communication technologies? I mean, do we really know how much energy is being consumed and how that compares to other industries, say the aviation industry or the transport industry?
Yes, it's interesting you mentioned the aviation industry. So in 2007, the firm Gartner did a study which concluded that about 2% of the greenhouse gas emissions are due to ICT, and that's the same proportion as is produced by the aviation industry.
But I presume that those figures will continue to rise as more and more people around the world, particularly in the developing world, get hooked up to the web. They get the internet and they get other social media devices which consume electricity.
True. Most recent figure I've heard was about 15% annual growth in the energy consumption of the internet compared to about 3% or so growth for total energy consumption. Another figure that I've heard is around 6% or so is in total due to e-commerce type activities, which includes things like if you buy a book online, then you don't have to physically travel to a bookshop, but that book is in fact then shipped to you. If you consider all of the energy costs and the packaging costs and such like, the energy costs of buying a book online is often more than driving to the bookshop and buying the book yourself.
And look, just finally, I mean, what are the implications for the future of the internet and its usage if we don't start to think about the implications of energy usage?
There were projections done a few years ago that said if things hadn't changed from a few years ago, the energy densities inside a microprocessor would have been soon rivaling those inside a nuclear reactor. So something had to change there. What changed in that context was the evolution towards multi-core processors. So that's one change that the industry has successfully made. But other changes are just, obviously, we're approaching the period that they call peak oil. For many, many years and centuries, in fact, people have been predicting that energy is going to be in short supply. Just a few weeks ago, you had a paleofuturist who was digging up an article from 1909 who was projecting that gas would be running out by 1935. All of these premature predictions have given people a false sense of security, but at some point, the world is going to start extracting less oil than the rate at which oil is being consumed. And when that does happen, that will cause very rapid increases in fuel prices and energy costs, and that will dramatically curtail the standard of living that we've become used to, both in terms of the internet and many other activities.
Lachlan Andrew from Swinburne University.